Hello, I'm Harriet Gilbert. Welcome to the World Book Club, where we're launching an international crime fiction season. Over the next 4 months, we'll be hearing from the authors of best-selling murder and mystery novels from Russia, the UK and Sweden. And we start with a Norwegian book in which memories of World War II and its aftermath explode half a century on into particularly ugly violence. The novel is called The Red Breast. It's sold 1 million copies in 40 languages, the English translation being by Don Bartlett. And here to answer questions about it from an invited audience and BBC listeners around the world is its author, Jo Nesbo.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, Jo, welcome to the World Book Club. I'm calling you Jo Nesbo because that's how your name looks to an English reader. It's not how it's actually pronounced, though, is it?
In English, it is. I sort of operate with different ways of pronouncing my name. But in Norwegian, it's Jo Nesbo.
Jo Nesbo.
Yeah, that's pretty close. Yeah.
May we call you Jo Nesbo?
That's okay with me.
Okay. Yeah. And your detective hero, again, he looks on the page to an English speaker like Harry Hole, but that's not how he's pronounced either.
In English, again, in English, Harry Hole is perfectly fine. In Norwegian, it's Harry Hole.
Harry Hole. Well, Harry, as I'm going to call him, has featured in 8 Jo Nesbo novels, from his first appearance in 1997's The Batman to his most recent in The Leopard. Harry's a bit of a loner, a man who's already been kicked by life and now has his defences up. He's got an edgy combination of ruthlessness and integrity, and he's an alcoholic, although at the start of The Red Breast he isn't drinking. What he's supposed to be doing instead is investigating Norway's neo-Nazis, who it's feared are about to mount an attack on the country's Muslims. But what he's actually doing is pursuing a case with its roots in World War II. Back then, in the aftermath of Nazi Germany's invasion of Norway, a number of Norwegians joined with the invaders to fight the Russians on the so-called Eastern Front. And although that might all seem like ancient history, the way those soldiers were punished as collaborators when the war ended still embitters one veteran of the front. He's learned he's got less than a year to live, and before dying, he's determined to kill those he considers Norway's real traitors, including those who fled the country when the Nazis occupied it. Can Harry stop him before his killing spree reaches its horrendous climax? Well, Jo Nesbo, of course, there are a whole number of plot strands that wind around that one, but I wonder if you'd start by reading a passage which flashes back to the Eastern Front. It's New Year's Eve, it's 1942, and a group of Norwegian soldiers are freezing and starving in this machine gun post when one of them, the rather dashing Daniel, suddenly produces a bottle of brandy from somewhere.
He put the bottle to his lips and threw back his head. The brown liquid gurgled and danced in the neck of the bottle. It twinkled as a glass reflected the light from the sinking flares. And in the years to come, Gudbrand would ponder whether it was the Russian sniper saw the gleam from the bottle. The next moment, Gudbrand heard a high-pitched popping noise and saw the bottle explode in Daniel's hands. There was a shower of glass and brandy, and Gudbrand closed his eyes. He could feel his face was wet. It ran down his cheeks, and instinctively he stuck out his tongue to catch a couple of drops. It tasted of almost nothing, just alcohol and something else, something sweet and metallic. The consistency was thick, probably because of the cold, Gudbrand thought, and he opened his eyes again. He couldn't see Daniel from the trench. He must have died behind the machine gun when he knew that he had been seen, Gudbrand guessed, but he could feel his heart racing. Daniel? No answer. Daniel? Gudbrand got to his feet and crawled out of the trench. Daniel was on his back with his cartridge belt under his head and the Russian cap over his face. The snow was splattered with brandy and blood. Gudbrand took the cap in his hand. Daniel was staring with wide eyes up at the starry sky. He had a large black gaping hole in the middle of his forehead. Gudbrand still had the sweet metallic taste in his mouth and felt nauseous.
Jo Nesbo, thank you very much. And that scene of violence, and indeed those two characters, Daniel and Gudbrand, will recur 50 years later in the present tense of the novel. Now, a question from the World Book Club audience for Jo Nesbo about the Redbreast.
My name is Monica and I'm from London now. And I work with a Norwegian company, and I work with a lot of Norwegians. We hear a lot about the resistance, and we, you know, glorified, you know, what they did during the World War. But we hear very little about people who fought on the Eastern Front. I heard somewhere that a lot of this aspect, historical aspect, was autobiographical. Is that true? Is there some personal history to the whole resistance Eastern Front bit?
It is, but. First, it is probably true also that the number of Norwegians that fought with the resistance movement were probably not that much larger than the number of Norwegians that fought with the Germans. It was approximately 5,000 to 7,000 young Norwegians that volunteered to fight with the Germans against the Russians. And this was at the time when, I mean, in 1940, Norway being situated between Russia and Germany. I think that many Norwegians probably thought that they had a choice between Stalin and Hitler. I mean, at the time, England and France and the rest of the old European democracies were more or less bankrupt. And it looked like Europe had two strong men. So the Redbreast also investigates this. What did the world look like to most Norwegians in 1940? And to some Norwegians, it looked like a choice between Stalin and Hitler. And my father, he was 18 when the war started. And he first was arrested when the, just after the Germans occupied Norway in April 9th, 1940. Because he had written some ugly things about Hitler on his desk in school. So he was thrown into jail, but a year later he volunteered to fight the Russians on the Eastern Front. At that time, when my father was 18, my mother was a very young girl, and she was working for the resistance movement in another city, just you know, some miles from Molde, where my, where my father lived at that time. So when I grew up, I heard, you know, all these wartime stories, but the interesting thing was that I heard them from both sides, both the resistance movement and the people who volunteered to fight against the Russians.
Well, still on that subject, we have an email from Beth Farrow, who wants to know, how important was it for you emotionally to set this novel in a context where you could explore the divisions in Norwegian society during World War II?
It was very important to me because I didn't know about my father, that he had, you know, fought with the Nazis until I was 15. I went to a museum in Molde and I would see a picture there, and there was someone in the picture that resembled my father. So I went back home and I told my father that I had seen this picture in the museum.
A picture of what?
It was a picture of a fireman in Molde during during the bombing. And I said that it looked like you. And then he said that, okay, your older brother, he already knows. And I had decided that you would be 16 until I told you, but I will tell you now. And then he told me about what he did during the war. And I didn't know that. So for me, it was a shock, because my father, you know, it was a person that I really admired and respected. And suddenly he was, you know, I tried to picture him, you know, wearing this famous Nazi helmet, German helmet. And it was in a way, it was like my world collapsed. So I sat down with my father and he said that you can ask me anything. I will try to explain. I will not give you any excuses, because after the war, I spent three years in prison. And I think that was a fair punishment for being as wrong as I was. But that's the way it is. So I started asking him questions about the war and why he made the choice he made. And after a while, I started forgetting, you know, about the political choice, because that was quite easy to understand after a while. He was a young man at the age of 18. But what started fascinating me was what happened in the trenches and after the war, and the people around him, what were their reasons for being there. And out of this grew this universe, you know, these comrades trying to survive in the trenches outside Leningrad. And that was sort of the basis for this book. And some of the most, you know, fantastic scenes that may be hard to believe, they are just true stories from my father's experiences in the trenches.
John Esbo, thank you very much. We've got a question for you now, which comes from Cynthia Bazinet in Holden in Massachusetts in the USA. And she's on the telephone now to ask it of you. Cynthia, hi, your question for Joe Nesbo.
Yes, thank you. I've been listening with interest to your comments, Mr. Nesbo, regarding the war. I guess now, as an American, I was astonished to discover this split in the Norwegian population. How has Norway reconciled these two mindsets subsequently? And does this split affect subsequent generations, the children such as yourself, of these Norwegians who chose one side or the other during the Second World War?
I grew up in the 60s and early 70s in Norway. And when we went to school, we didn't hear much about the people fighting with the Germans. We heard all the stories about the people fighting with the resistance movement. But I think this is typical for European countries that were occupied by the Germans during the war. In the 70s, there was a film series in France that was to show how the French people also cooperated with the Germans and the Vichy regime in France. But it was stopped. And the chief of the French TV channel said that the French were not yet ready to have their concept of the war or their illusions of the French resistance movement destroyed by this TV series. And I think to a certain extent it was the same thing in Norway. Norway is a young nation. It was only won its independence in 1905. And it's important for a young country to build a healthy self-image. And I think the image of the Norwegians fighting the Germans during the Second World War was very important for the Norwegian nation. So it was very tough for Norway as a nation to see the whole story, that there were many Norwegians fighting with the Germans. And like my father told me, there were people from all over the world actually traveling to Europe, to the Eastern Front, to fight for Hitler against Stalin. You had even people from Australia coming there. I mean, what did they have to do there? Anyway, that was the way at least some young people looked at the world at that time, that Hitler was a kind of a savior. And I think that young historians in Norway the last two decades have started writing about the war and the war efforts, the resistance movement, and the people fighting with the Germans in a different way. I think that now the young generation in Norway is ready to be told the true story.
Cynthia, thank you very much indeed. And another question now from the audience, the World Book Club audience, for Joe Nesbo.
Hi, I'm Michelangelo from Italy. My question is, why do you think, in your opinion, The Redbreast is the most popular book of all the one you've written so far?
I don't know, really, but probably I think that there's a personal story there. And there's a story there that I had been wanting to tell for many years. I wrote two books before The Redbreast, but in many ways, they are sort of a build-up, I think, to The Redbreast. Now, my father, he was actually, I sort of wrote his novel. He was going to write that story himself. But he died at the age of 72. He had just retired, and he was going to write a novel. But he didn't have the time to do that. So in a way, I wrote my father's novel. So it's a very personal story. And although it's a crime story, it's entertainment, I think that the passion I have for the story, it's sort of you can tell, hopefully, when you read the book.
Your father isn't the murderous old veteran, is he?
No, it's not. but it's like, for example, the scene that I read here about two friends spending New Year's Eve in the trenches on guard. And that is my father's story. This is actually what happened to my father. He was sitting there in the trenches and they were speaking about Norway, about being home, you know, for Christmas, what they had to eat for Christmas. They were hungry all the time. They were cold and hungry and they had lice. And so they thought more about those things than actually being shot. And they were sitting there and in the middle of a sentence, my father's friend's head would just explode and he was dead, you know, in the middle of a sentence, being shot by a Russian sniper. And the first job that my father had to do after his friend was shot was to disassemble the weapon and scrape off, you know, the remains of his friend from the weapon, because it was 30 degrees below zero, so you had to be really fast, you know, for in order to have the weapon function again. So that was how he spent his New Year's Eve. And, you know, it's stories like that. When you hear that at the age of 15, 16, you pretty much know that, okay, these are important stories. These are stories that you have to pass on. And that's what I've done with the Redbreast.
Good afternoon, Mr. Nesba.
Thank you.
I'm a writer too from London. My name is Durlab Singh. And my question is, you are a crime writer, and I gather you are an economist also. And money and crime normally goes together, which intrigues me. You are a pop musician also. How does it fit music with the other two categories?
Okay.
How does music fit with your crime fiction?
Yeah. Well, I think the job I had as a stockbroker, I did that to pay the rent, and the music was my passion for music. I started playing in a band together with my brother when I was really young, and then I went to Bergen and I studied for many years. But then when I moved to Oslo, we started playing with a band, and we toured as a band, and then we had a record contract and we started recording. So, but I think what I did with the band was to tell stories. I wrote the songs and the lyrics, but the songs were all about storytelling. So actually when I started writing novels, I think the people that knew me, they were less surprised that I started writing novels than when I started playing in a band. Actually, when I published my first novel and I told my friends, they just said, "What took you so long?" I think if there's one thing I've been doing my whole life, it's telling stories.
Thank you, Joe Nesba. Another question.
My name is Sadhu Sader. I'm originally Indian, but I live in London. As a writer, can you comment, please, Mr. Joe Nesba? Apparently, the original writing of The Red Breast was written in Norwegian language. Mm. Does your story get lost or distorted in translation in different languages?
Hopefully not the whole story, but things will get lost in translation. I mean, languages are complicated things. And I know that things will get lost. What gets lost first, I think, is the humor. It's really difficult to translate. I think my English translator Don Bartlett, from what I hear, he has done a great job with my books. But I don't read the books myself because it would be so frustrating. Now I could do that in order to try to control the translation, but I think it's important that also the translator, you know, that they have the feeling that they are writing their own story, that they have some kind of ownership to the story. So I have to trust him. That's all I can do. As for other languages like Italian and Japanese and Korean, I don't know those languages. So I don't know what they're doing. Hopefully they're doing a good job.
We seem to have a kind of Indian moment. I've got an email now which comes from Sanjay Singh Chauhan in India, who writes this: One part of the Redbreast is based on World War II Nazism. One part is about neo-Nazism. But isn't our current democracy system, which allows people to feel free and know their rights, very different from the situation in the 1930s and 1940s? So I guess Sanjay Singh's talking about the connection between Nazism in the 30s and neo-Nazism in Norway now.
I don't think that neo-Nazism is a big problem in Norway. It's not like it's threatening the political system in Norway. And it never has, really. So the story is actually about the Nazism during the Second World War. There is a milieu of rebels in Oslo and Norway and in most Scandinavian countries. But I believe it's not that much about politics. Yes, I agree. It's not a problem. But it's interesting that when you're a rebel in well-functioning societies like the Scandinavian societies, in order to provoke, what you do is that you claim you're a Nazi. That is like the worst thing you can be, I think, in a Scandinavian society. And it really provokes people, and especially the elder generation.
Well, if we could meet now one of your rebels, a neo-Nazi. This is a moment he's in court, he's on trial. And here he's deciding to read his big fascist rant from the dock.
"That's the great betrayal," the shaved-head man said, looking down at his manuscripts. The head, the eyebrows, the bulging forearms, even the huge hands gripping the lectern, everything was clean-shaven and neat. He leaned over the microphone. "Since 1945, National Socialism's enemies have been masters of the land. They have developed and put into practice their democratic and economic principles. Consequently, not on one single day has the sun gone down on a world without war. Even here in Europe, we have experienced war and genocide. In the Third World, millions starve to death, and Europe is threatened by mass immigration and the resultant chaos, deprivation, and struggle for survival." He paused to gaze around him. There was a stony silence in the room. Only one person in the audience, on the benches behind him, clapped tentatively. Then he continued, fired up now. The red light under the microphone lit up ominously, indicating that the recording signal was distorted. "The previous great betrayal took place on 9th April 1940, when our so-called national leaders fled from the enemy to save their own skins and took the gold reserves with them to finance a life of luxury in London. Now the enemy is here again, and those who are supposed to protect our interests have let us down once more. They let the enemy build mosques in our midst, let them rob our old folk and mingle blood with our women. It is no more than our duty as Norwegians to protect our race and to eliminate those who fail us." He turned the page, but the cough from the podium in front of him made him stop and look up. "Thank you. I think we heard enough," the judge said, peering over his glasses. "Has the prosecution counsel any more questions for the accused?"
John Esbo, thank you very much. And we've got a question now from Sue Jesperson. She's an Irish listener to the BBC World Book Club, but she's been living for the past 11 years in Haugesund on the west coast of Norway. And she wants to know this. Why did you introduce the neo-Nazis into the book? Was it primarily so that Harry Hole could link the present day to past events and solve the crime?
Yes.
You've got it, Sue. You got it. So that was just, they were simply a device. It's interesting, actually, that you describe the neo-Nazis as being insignificant, because you start thinking that this guy, the one we've just heard on trial, is a really dangerous thug, and indeed, actually, he is precisely that. But you also show him to be a very pathetic character. I mean, he's somebody who's, you know, faints at the sight of blood, which isn't a great deal of good for a killer, and who's obviously dominated by his mum. I mean, was part of your intention to make him seem not only frightening but also absurd?
He's
he's an individual. He's I didn't put him there to represent, you know, the neo-Nazis or something. So he's just, and I'm not even sure if that is an important part of his personality. He's just a guy who has been caught up, you know, in this milieu, and that is true, I think, for most of my characters. I don't want them to represent, for example, if there's a woman, sometimes you will get criticized because you have portrayed a woman in a certain way, because some readers will see her as a represent for all women in the world. For me, it doesn't work that way. It's about individuals. And so I needed this kind of character in the book, and that's why he's there.
Well, we have now a question for you, Joe Nesbo, from a British listener to the BBC World Service called Heather Lyons. And she emailed this to the programme. When Harry visits Rwanda in your latest novel, The Leopard, so she's been quick off the mark, she's already read your new book. Mm. When he visits Rwanda, he's offered a gun which is the same type as the rare gun used by the killer in The Redbreast, a Märklin rifle. What's the fascination for you of that particular gun? And before you answer that, can I add my own question? Is it actually a real gun, or did you invent it?
I invented the gun. It's not real. The caliber, for example, is too heavy for a gun to work in real life. So I invented. This is a gun that the Germans invented many years ago. It was to shoot elephants. So it was for elephant hunting.
So there is an original for it?
No, this is a gun that I'm making up.
Oh, right. But okay, you're making it up as you talk.
Yes,
okay,
I am. Yeah. But they had, you know, the optic that they used. You hardly need, you know, great optics to shoot an elephant. But everything about this gun is, you know, a little bigger than life. And so I used it. And the name, I particularly like the name because I don't know if you had this toy trains in here in England.
No, but not those ones.
Märklin, that was the brand name of the. So I sort of like the idea of a gun having the name of a toy, and I've been asked a lot about this gun. You know,
people interested to know where they can get hold of one.
Well, at least they're interested in guns, and but yeah, it's. It's my only invention. But when you're writing a series, I like the idea of things popping up later in a book. It's not like you need to have read The Redbreast in order to appreciate the Märklin gun in The Leopard. But it's a small bonus for those who have written the whole series.
Well, I do admit I looked Märklin up on the internet, and the only references I could find to it, but there were a phenomenal amount of references, all referred back to your book. So it's kind of acquired a new existence thanks to you, this gun.
Hello, Joe. My name's Chris Luxford-Noyes. I was just thinking about Harry himself. Throughout crime fiction, there's always been a maverick policeman or a loner. Harry, is he a composite? Who is he? Is he you? Is he people you know, a mixture? Or is he just someone you thought up?
When I first came up with the character of Harry Hole, he was a combination of a Norwegian football trainer and police officer in the village where my grandmother lived. We used to have our summer holidays there, and when I was a kid, my grandmother used to tell me that if you're not home by 8 o'clock, Hole will come get you. And I had never seen this character, Hole, but I imagined him to be, you know, really tall, big guy, you know, scary guy. And I was at the funeral some years ago. A relative had died, and there was this small old man, really old man, would come up to me, and you know, he would have this really cold, icy blue eyes, and he would give me his thin, hard hand and shake my hand and say, "I am Hole." And, my first thought would be, "But it's not 8 o'clock yet." But it was a combination of some people I know. Now, when you start reading a series, or at least in my case, I was pretty convinced that it had nothing to do with me. But now, after having written 8 Harry Hole novels, I realized that I have probably put more of my own personality into my character than I realized. I think it's inevitable. It has to do with him being the hero of the story. So at least you use your own basic values, maybe your political views, and at least you use your preferences in popular culture in your hero. He tends to like the same music that I do. He tends to not like the movies I don't like. Yeah.
We did have a question from Andy Royal, care of our Facebook page, who wanted to know if Harry's taste in music reflected your own. I mean, as a
yes.
chart-topping musician yourself.
Yeah, well, I'm very disappointed that he's actually not a fan of my band. He doesn't care much about the writer's music. So
you could be very postmodern and put that in, couldn't you?
Yeah, I could. But I think he prefer Stones to the Beatles. I prefer the Beatles. I actually think that Rolling Stones is a great band, but probably a bit overrated.
Wow. Joe Nesbo, you may have lost yourself a few readers there.
I know.
Dangerous. Well, we've got a question now which comes from Hertfordshire in the UK. It's from Russell Barash. And he's on the telephone now to ask it to you himself.
Yes. Hello, Joe. I felt worried by the way Tom Waller, one of the murderers, gets away scot-free. Did you not want to see Ellen's murder avenged at all?
This is one of the killings in the book committed, as we discover, by... So anybody who hasn't read the book yet, close your ears for a second. But committed by a fellow cop, Tom Waller, do you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. This is a series, so there are more books. The story goes on.
You wanted him to get his comeuppance, did you there, Russell?
Yes, absolutely. That's a shame. I'll just have to keep reading then.
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
It's interesting because, Joe Nesbo, you leave several plot strands dangling. I mean, there's not just that one, but there's Harry's love affair with the rather gorgeous and, I think, very lovely Raquel. And I wonder if you could just hear a bit now from the book. This is when they are sort of getting it together, although it's not really helped by Raquel's young son, Oleg, being in the house. And Raquel here is just been crying.
She turned to Harry. And it was only now that he saw she was crying. The tears rolled down her cheeks and collected under her chin. She made no attempt to stop them. Well, Harry began, and that was all he managed to say before they were in each other's arms. They clung to each other as to a life buoy. Harry was shaking. Just this, Harry thought, just this is enough. Just holding her like this. Mummy! The shout came from the first floor. Where's the Game Boy? In one of the drawers in the dressing table, Raquel shouted in a quivering voice. Start at the top. Kiss me, she whispered to Harry. But Oleg might, it's not in the dressing table. When Oleg came downstairs with the Game Boy, which he finally found in the toy box, he didn't notice the atmosphere in the sitting room at first and laughed at Harry, who was humming with concern at seeing the new score. But as soon as Harry set off to beat the new record, he heard Oleg say, "What's up with your face?" Harry looked at Raquel, who was only just capable of keeping a straight face. "It's because we like each other so much," Harry said, replacing 3 lines with 1 long line out on the right. "And your record is on the ropes now, loser." Oleg laughed and slapped Harry on the shoulder. No chance. You're the loser.
Joe Nesbo, thank you very much. And I know that Raquel does reappear in later books. When you do that, when you leave plot strands or relationships kind of hanging at the end of a book, is that in a very Charles Dickens way? It's like, hey, you're going to have to buy the next book to find out what's happening. Is that why you do it, or is it because you don't like tidy resolutions, or what?
I like to tie it up a little bit, but if it's too perfect, it doesn't feel right. You know, in real life, you don't solve everything. Hopefully, you will solve the important things. And I also like the feeling of a series. I like that feeling. You know that there's a before and there's an after, and I write each book as a standalone. It's not like you have to have read any of the previous books, but there is a bonus for the loyal reader.
One of the things about that scene that interests me is that it's not very typical. It's a very tender, affectionate, erotic, but domestic scene. Mm. And by and large, the sense of Harry we get, I mean, I know he's based on you, so I shall tread carefully here, but we get the sense of somebody who's usually alone and miserable and antisocial. Mm. And it seemed to me that actually a lot of the great detectives of fiction are just like that, you know, whether it's Sherlock Holmes or Philip Marlowe, that there is something about them that they require for some purpose or other to have an unsatisfactory private life. I mean, is there something that you find as an author writing crime fiction that your detective just couldn't be a happily married, contented man without a drink problem?
I think that what you're looking for in the story is of course drama, but in order to have drama in a story, you have to have conflict. And in a crime story, you have, of course, a conflict, external conflict, which is a person or several person have been killed. And there's a police officer who is trying to find the murderer. And that's a conflict because the murderer is, of course, trying to get away with it. But often the most interesting theme in a story is the internal conflict. And in order to have an internal conflict within your main character, it's easier to have a person with the kind of life and the kind of personality that Harry has. He has a drinking problem. That is his Achilles heel, so to speak. He can't function when he starts drinking. And he is a controversial person, and he's a loner. I think it's just he's better suited for the kind of stories that that I'm writing. But also, as a main character, I give him moral dilemmas. And I think what you're really interested in the story is what choices are your main character going to make? Is he going to make the right choice? Is he going to do the right thing? Is his eternal soul going to heaven, or is it going to hell? I think we are more interested in that than in whether our hero will survive physically.
Hi, my name's Sharon May, and I belong to a crime reading group in Sussex. And it sort of follows on from your question. We've been reading about various detectives from around the world, and it seems that climate often plays a big part in their characters, and the more northerly you get, seem to get the more depressive alcoholic characters like Rebus and Valander and Harry. And whereas a character that we're reading about in Florence seems to go home to his wife at lunchtime, have a bottle of wine, and then spend months solving the crime. I just wondered whether you could comment on that sort of reasoning for the,
yes.
The further north you go, the the more depressed you're likely to be.
I'm trying to come up with an example of a really unhappy character who is living under the sun. And
Mike Nichol, who writes crime fiction set in Cape Town in South Africa, certainly has a quite miserable, well, he's a security guard, but he operates as the detective figure in his books. Mind you, his wife has just been killed, so that accounts for his misery. Perhaps that sort of counteracts the sunshine.
Yeah, that was the only example we came up with, so you're right. No, I think it's a myth, you know, the sort of image of Scandinavian countries, you know, being populated by really depressed people.
I did live in Denmark for a year, and I disagree everybody is depressed. But I do have arguments with people who are just reading the books for the first time and have never been, and that's the impression that they get.
Yeah, so I guess that it's it has more to do with the genre of the crime novel than with, you know, the Scandinavian societies and people.
Come to think of it, Philip Marlowe was in Los Angeles, which is you know, foggy, but not exactly Nordic.
Oh, hello there, Joe. Name's Mike. I come from Gillingham in the county of Kent. At what point in time do you realise that you are creating a series of books? And does this restrict you in any way from creating another hero in another series?
When I wrote my first novel, I was pretty sure it wasn't a series. And that was simply because it was my first attempt at writing a novel. So I was pretty sure it was not going to be published. I was hoping for a polite letter of refusal saying that we can't publish this, but we see some talent here, so please send us something new. And even after the first novel, when I was sitting down to write my second novel, I was sure I was going to use Harry Hole again. But when I decided to do so, during the writing of my second novel, I knew that this is a series. And that had to do with the fact that I was intrigued by the character and I saw possibilities of developing in the character. Yes, when you decide to write a series, there are some restrictions, of course. You have to concentrate on that. The good thing is that you know the characters and you know the universe. And, of course, you have to decide, is the universe and the characters interesting enough? So for me, the stories would be totally different if Harry hadn't been Harry and, for example, Tom Bowler hadn't been the Tom Bowler. So although I'm the master of the story, and I don't believe in writers who say that they sit down and they wonder what is going to happen. Hopefully, I hope they have a plan. At least I have a plan. But I have to take some turns and twists that I didn't expect. And that has to do with the characters. And I think that at some point, you have to realize that you have finished the story about the character. And that's the case with Harry also. He will not have eternal life, and the series will have to end somewhere, but not today.
Do you have a sense of how close that time is?
I have a storyline for Harry. I know how his life is going to end, yes. So I will not say that the end is near, but the end is nearer.
Thank you, Joe. Very helpful. A question for you now, which was emailed in from Moss in Norway. In fact, could I ask you to read the name of the person who sent it? Because I'll just get it wrong.
It's Hilde Kjærstad.
Hilde Kjærstad would like to ask you this. In fact, this is really sort of a bit of fan mail. She says, Joe Nesbø, you're a very talented man, writer, musician. You've made a few really great songs. But how do you find the time for everything?
Well, I do work a lot. I was a bit worried when I stopped, when I quit my day job, I started to write full time. I was worried, that I would, become an alcoholic or something, that I wouldn't get up in the morning. So I was worried that I didn't have the discipline. But, I have the best job in the world, I think. Being a writer, it's a privilege. And being a writer and having readers. So for me, it's writing is something that I would have done for free. I think it's Bruce Springsteen in a song who's saying that I've been paid a king's ransom for doing what comes naturally. And that's the way I feel. I have some years left in me, hopefully. And I'm in a hurry, I have all these stories that I have to tell. While there's still time.
So these days, does the music just get packed in around the edges?
I don't write songs. I haven't done that for many years. I've written like one song a year, and we don't record with our band any longer. We just we have like a contract with our fans that when we play concerts now, we don't play songs that are younger than 12 years.
This question for you here comes from Claire Mitchell, who's a UK listener to the BBC World Service. And she just wants to know this. Why do you think Scandinavian crime fiction has become so popular throughout the West? I mean, I guess she's thinking obviously of yourself, but Stieg Larsson, Henning Mankell, Anne Holt. Mm. I mean, there's at the moment it's the fiction.
Some of it
has to do with luck, of course, that you have some door openers like Henning Mankell and Stig Larsson. But hopefully it also has to do with the quality of the Scandinavian crime writing. There is a tradition in Scandinavia for writing crime. In the 70s, you had two Swedish writers, Sjöwall and Wahlöö, who wrote political crime novels. But they also changed the crime fiction scene in Scandinavia, because after Sjöwall and Wahlöö, it was okay for talented young writers to focus on the crime novel. And it sort of took the pulp fiction from the kiosks and into the serious bookstores.
Yeah, we did have a question about precisely about their influence and their influence on you.
Mm. Yes, and I think they influenced all the Scandinavian crime writers, even those who have never heard about Sjöwall and Wahlöö, because we are all standing on the shoulders of giants. It has to do with tradition. We're in a tradition of Scandinavian crime writing. And yes, I think that there are so many good, talented crime writers around. And even, you know, the writers who concentrate on other genres of literature, like Lars Saabye Christensen, for example, who wrote The Half-Brother. He and many of the other writers has at one point written a crime novel. It's like it's in Scandinavia, it's like a thing that you should do at one point or another.
I suppose one downside is that on your books published in Britain, there's a sticker on it which says, it's a quote from a newspaper review, it says, "The next Stieg Larsson." We have a question about that from Luana O'Hare via our Facebook site. And it's, how do you feel about being compared to Stieg Larsson? Personally, I love your writing more than his.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Well, it's not my favorite tag. I mean, but the cover and the things on the cover, I don't care too much about it. It has to do with marketing, and I write the books, and if you think it's a good thing to market it with Stieg Larsson on it, go ahead. I mean, I don't mind. It could have been worse. I mean, I could have been the next Dan Brown.
Hello, I'm Gemma from Nottingham. You talked about the kind of mythical gun that we've covered off in the Redbreast. I'm just wondering where your other kind of instruments of torture came from. Like, where did you make them up from? Kind of the snowman, and also, more latest, the leopard. I mean, kind of a horrible way to die with the ball. I'm just wondering, where did you? Well, are they real? Do they exist?
No, they don't. Hopefully, they don't. I'm not sure whether I have a fascination with torture, instruments. But the idea for the Leopold's apple in my latest novel, the Leopard, it was from when I visited my grandmother during summer holiday.
I think you're going to first have to describe how this instrument of torture works. I know, and it's particularly horrible. But
yes, it's a sort of a metal ball. With springs in it, and so when you have it in your mouth, you can't get it out again. And if you pull the string, there will be needles, coming out from the ball, and you will probably not be killed by the needles itself, but from the blood, you will drown in your own blood. And the idea for this instrument probably came from, from my grandmother. when we went there for our holidays, she had a big garden with apple trees in it, and she said that we were not allowed to pick apples, but she didn't say anything about eating apples. So what me and my brother did was we would climb into the trees and eat the apples without picking them. So at the end of the summer, you'd see a apple tree full with half-eaten apples in it. But one day, my brother dared me to put a particular big apple into my mouth to see if I could get it into my mouth. And I could, but I couldn't get it out again. And I still hadn't picked the apple, so it was still attached to the tree. So I was lying there on the branch thinking that, oh, this apple is still growing.
you know, little by little. And if I stay 3 weeks, what will happen? Will my head eventually explode? And I think that was something that I took with me, you know, that I thought about the idea of the apple that makes your head explode.
You may have already, by implication, answered this question. We have a question now from Sofiane Time in Algeria, who writes this. Joe, who are you in normal life? What kind of person are you, and how do you live your life?
Is it a good thing for me to reveal that, do you think? A storyteller. I know that some people, they think that I am Harry Hole, and I'm not. But as a storyteller, I rather not stand in the way of my story. I rather have focus on Harry and not on myself, because I think it's like when I read books that are written by friends of mine. It's disturbing. I prefer not to know the storyteller. It's distracting for the story. But to give an answer, I'm just a guy who loves making up stories. That's it.